revolution never come with a warning. A revolution never sends you an omen. A revolution just arrive like the morning. Ring the alarm, we come to wake up the snoring. They're telling you to never worry about the future. They're telling you to never worry about the torture. They're telling you that you will never see the horror. Spend it all today and we will bill you tomorrow. Bank accounts in Bahamas. Wall Street crime will never send you to the slammer. Tell all the children in the arms of the mamas, the F-15 is a homicide bomber. TV commercial for a popper pill culture. Drug companies circling like a vulture. Amaraki babies with the G.I. Joe father. 10 years from now, is anybody gonna bother you? Fire. Sends you an omen. A revolution never come with a warning. A revolution. Everyone addicted to the same nicotine. Everyone addicted to the same gasoline. Everyone addicted to a technicolor screen. Everybody trying to get their hands on the same green. From the banks of the river to the banks of the greedy. All of the riches taken back by the needy. We come from the country and we come from the city. Play us on a record, you can play us on a CD. All the shit you've given us is fertilizer. The seeds that you planted, you can never brutalize. Tell a corporation you can never globalize. It, like Peter Tosh said, legalize it. Girls and boys hear the bass and the treble. Rumble in the speakers and it make you want a rebel. Throw your hands up, take it to another level. And you never, ever, ever make a deal with the devil. Yeah. With a warning, revolution never send you an omen. Revolution never come with a warning.
CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Inkstud Show, the radio show where we talk about comics. Are you settled, Colin? I'll take that as a yes. Our guest this week is Peter Cooper. Is it pronounced Cooper?
Yep.
Okay. And the song was Michael Fronte and Spearhead, Yell Fire, which kind of feels apropos for the for your work. And talking about the revolution and, I guess, political dissidents?
Yeah.
Yeah. Peter has a lot of books. Most notably, most recent is the latest issue of World War III Illustrated, issue number 39, which you've been doing for coming on 30 years now. Almost, with your partner in crime, Seth Tobachman, as well. Your latest collection is, I don't want to use the phrase, your graphic novel. Stop Forgetting to Remember. What else we got? Speechless, New York, New York, The Jungle, and a whole slew of Kafka adaptations. Anything I'm missing?
Oh, yes, The System.
The System,
yeah. That, you know. It's been many years. So.
I could probably just go through the bibliography at the back of Speechless, but...
No, that's all right. That's boring.
There we go.
It's online somewhere, so...
There we go. Go to... what's your website? Is it Cooper Art, isn't it?
No, it's petercooper.com.
Petercooper.com, spelled K-U-P-E-R. Yeah. So I guess we'll jump into it. You've got a lot of stuff to cover, like we're saying. There's a lot of comics. I kind of want to start out by talking about what got you into comics and kind of... your development in comics, because it's interesting looking at your background, because you went to the Pratt, you studied under Howard Chaykin, or not studied, I guess... You worked for and was the whipping boy of Howard Chaykin. So let's start out, what was your draw into comics?
Probably, you know, when I was quite young, I was reading Marvel, and... you know, Thor, I think, was one of the first ones, and I like, you know, anything by Jack Kirby. And then that sort of faded, and then my father had a sabbatical year, and we lived in Israel for a year when I was 10.
And you were on a kibbutz, right?
Well, I'm sorry?
You were on a kibbutz in...
No. I lived in Haifa. My father was teaching at a university there, and it was just the regular old, you know, lived in an apartment building. And while I was there, I was grabbing anything that was in English, and comics were certainly that. I was reading a lot of, I think, Richie Rich and Little Dot and Batman, and it was I was on that line where I wasn't just being a Marvelite as I had been. And when I got back from Israel, I found that the only person I could relate to was Seth Tobachman, and he and I had grown up together. We from as far back as first grade, and lived a street apart. Our fathers both were university professors, and he was into comics and had a, you know, like a real serious collection. And it just opened the door on. I started looking at him, and it something rang. I think I saw a Captain America origin issue and just loved it. And in 1970, we had heard about a comic convention in Detroit, the Detroit Triple Fanfare, and we actually got his parents to take us to Detroit. And so in 1970, when I was 11, they were getting to meet Bernie Wrightson and Jim Stranko, and I saw my first underground comics material. I saw Promethean Enterprises, which was a fanzine that had Crumb in it, and Rick Griffin, and Seth bought a tabloid of Trash Man by Spain. Totally floored me. I just like looked at him, because he was straddling those worlds between that sort of action art and then, you know, but then they're fighting against the police.
Yeah.
And so it was this amazing, it was amazing to see these things happen. And then I think it was maybe 19, right in there, we actually started doing a fanzine. We interviewed some people. Cleveland had, which is where I grew up, had a pretty solid comic scene with Don and Maggie Thompson were there, who went on to do the comics Buyer's Guide. And there was a number of other comics people. Tony Isabella was there. People are still sort of, you know, writing about or participating in comics. And they'd gather together in a small group. And we got very serious about it very quickly. And I had the opportunity to meet artists at conventions very early on when they were really small.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was Seth and I were coming back from buying comics one day, and kid saw us with comics and said, "Hey, there's a guy up the street who has comics." And it turned out that guy was Harvey Pekar. And this was in 1970 or 71, so Harvey was a guy who worked in a hospital who'd never written a comic before. And we rang his doorbell. He let us in. Just, you know, we said, "We understand you have comics. Can we come up?" And he was like, "Oh, I guess so." And we just, you know, literally just, you know, walked in, and then he showed us back in the back room. He had this incredible 78 RPM record collection, and he pulled out an original piece of art by Crumb that was the first version of what was going to later be, I think. Was it Head Comics? Anyway, it was just this cartoon character peeing in a toilet with his genitals hanging out, and it just completely blew my mind, just the combination of cartoon and genitals.
How old
and
were you?
11, 12. And fortunately, I had older sisters who had boyfriends who would bring underground comics into our home. And also the hippie culture at that time, there was just this sort of the conspiracy of, let's say, a store owner who could have gotten into some pretty major trouble. I mean, these days, you know, that's happened more than once, that would sell me underground comics when I was underage. And that was an incredibly, you know, formative thing to see Von Bode and all the Crumb books. And every time something new came in, this guy would go, you know, psst, I got these comics. And, you know, I'd quickly buy them. And but I was at the same time reading superhero comics all through until the mid 70s, and about 75 or so, I started to lose interest in it, and I was starting to smoke more pot, or I was starting to think that this was some childish thing to be put away. But then, of course, pot and underground comics work beautifully together, and I had probably a dividing line in my life where I was just about to call it quits on the comic scene, and I got mono, which is, a traditional kind of high school disease where I just dropped into bed for about a month, and all I did in there was read comics and start drawing. And then I got out of bed and said, I know what I want to do.
And it's all downhill from there.
I know what I want to do. I want to be unemployed most of the time and struggle and be told no very often.
A lifetime of no.
Yes.
Now, I was reading somewhere that you would trade records with Crumb for comics or something.
Well, it was one incident, and this, again, came through Harvey, just another one of those crazy, like, you can't make this up type of deals. I found in the basement of my parents' house, when I was a kid, the previous owner had left his collection of 78 RPM records. Why? I don't know. He just left them. We were having a yard sale, and my parents said, those can be yours. You call the guy up and make sure he doesn't want them. I did, and he was like, yeah, they're yours, kid. And I had them sitting outside, and it was like a sunny day, and there were a couple of them, sitting at an angle. And some record collector showed up and saw them and just grabbed one of them up, ran inside, and said, where's the telephone book? And put a telephone book on it because they were warping in the sun. And it turned out they were pretty valuable 78 RPM records. And I remembered, oh, yeah, Harvey has some of those. So I called him up. I didn't sell any of this to the collector because I, as a collector myself, I smelled, collector, wait, there could be value here. And Harvey came over and he said, yeah, I think some Crumb would like some of these. And he took about 15 of them. And I said, listen, I'll make you a trade. I was doing a fanzine with Seth. And we'll do an interview. We'll write out questions for Crumb, and we typed up all these questions, and it was going to trade the interview and one piece of original art for 1578 RPM records. So we typed up these questions, and they were things like, can you give us a rundown on the history of underground comics with a giant space for him to write in, and what are your hobbies, and what kind of pen nib do you use? And we sent it off, and I forget how long went by, but it was quite a while. But then Harvey called me up one night and said, yeah, I got the stuff for you. And I rode my bike up to him, and in the interview where it said, can you give us a complete rundown on the history of underground comics with this giant space, he wrote no. And for hobbies, it was something like doing lots of drugs, eating a lot of food, fucking a lot of women and girls, and eventually dying. And he's really, he had all these really funny answers, and that did or didn't fit the space we'd left for him. And he ended the interview with saying that we should enjoy comics more, but don't take them so goddamn seriously. Comic and sci-fi fans of the world, get laid. And when we went to print it in our zine, I was having my dad's secretary type it up, and she stopped at the first fuck, and fortunately my mom was kind enough to type it up so we could get it, offset printed. And we printed up 100 copies of the interview in our zine. It's called Gaslight. It was the Graphic Arts Society magazine of Cleveland. And we printed 100 copies, and they miraculously sold out, which the last issue hadn't sold as many copies. We couldn't fully figure it out because I wasn't, in 1972, I was still a little unclear on who Robert Crumb was, and then later, or that was 71, and then maybe in 72, I just had one of those awakenings and just, you know, saw this whole world of what he was doing. But he came through Cleveland and came over with, he was traveling with the Cheap Suit Serenaders at the time, mm-hmm. and they were this band that he was traveling with, and he came over and they went through all the records and we made another trade. He did the cover for our zine and trade for, I don't know, like a handful of records, maybe it was 40 records or something like that. And at the time I thought, you know, he's kind of getting a good deal with the 40 records for one little drawing. But, and I, you know, I died a thousand tiny deaths thinking about my behavior around him. But I went over there and he hadn't even started on the drawing yet. And he said, you know, sit down, I'll get to it now. And he gave me his sketchbooks to look at. And I just got a complete course in R. Crumb looking at his sketchbooks. And I said, look, you know, that's a lot of records for the one drawing. How about if you, can I get, you know, maybe can I photocopy some of these drawings and print them? And he was like, okay. And he gave me the sketchbook, which I rode off on my bicycle holding in one hand, and went up to the library and photocopied a bunch of it. And I ended up printing a zine called Mellotunes that had, that was made up of those sketches and then a reprinting of the interview with Crumb. And again, I discovered this sort of whole world of people who loved his work, and I was becoming one of them more and more. And I actually printed a second issue of it and then had a great experience of remorse and threw them all out. So I sold the first handful of them and then threw out, I guess I probably printed maybe 1,500 copies, and I threw out about 1,000.
Wow. That's a young age to get so involved. It's a lifelong love of the comics.
Yeah, well, it was pretty fortunate because I had Seth Tobachman's enthusiasm and the people that were in Cleveland that just incidentally happened to be there, and the comic conventions being in striking distance, so that we were. You know, sort of like my year was wrapped around getting ready to go to the New York Comic Convention, and they were so small at the time that it was a, you know, gave me the opportunity to meet people doing this, and it made it seem like a possibility. You know, I could meet Bill Gaines and, you know, interview him. Seth and I interviewed Bill Gaines. We interviewed Jack Kirby and Neil Adams and Von Bode and a lot of all these people. And I mean, I only wish I had better questions at the time. But so sometimes we did. Seth was infinitely wiser than I was, and had better, more sort of, you know. I think we interviewed Russ Heath, who had done all these war comics, and Seth was asking him pointed questions about doing war comics that might be glorifying war. And, you know, when he was about 15, I was like, "Go on, girl." And it was, you know, I was listening to some of these old interviews on, I have them on these dying cassettes, and I was like, wow. And our voices are real high, and, you know, just cracking before, you know, we hadn't entered puberty yet.
Oh, I'd love to hear that. When did you guys decide to go to the Pratt, and what was the decision with going there?
I moved to New York for a job in animation in 1977. Seth had already moved here to go to film school at NYU. And I came to New York I had gone to Kent State for a year before. I started school when I was 18, just on the young edge of the birthday cycle. And so on spring break, I came to New York and went looking for any job I could find in animation. I wanted to get to New York, and I wanted to get rolling in some way. And some animation house said that they would give me a job. They were working on, I think it was Raggedy Ann and Andy at the time, and needed, you know, a million people to paint blue backgrounds. So the guy said, okay, I got a job for you, you know, come this summer. And I moved to New York for this job, and I came knocking on the guy's door. He had no idea who I was, and he, you know, sort of vaguely told me to call him in 6 or 7 weeks, and I called him for, I don't know, 8 months every period of time, and I looked for other work in animation, and I got some little bits of illustration work, but it was clear I was utterly ill-equipped. I didn't have any particularly any great talent in the drawing area, and I was really just starting then to seriously try to get my chops together, so I just thought I need schooling. And right around the time I was getting into school, I bumped into Howard Chaykin, and I had met Howard when he was 19 and I was 12, and he was just getting into the field, and so I saw him every year at the comic conventions as he made his way up and had done Star Wars at this point, and he said he was between assistants, and because he incidentally knew me from all these years, and I told him I was, you know, in New York doing this, trying to be an artist, then he told me to come by and gave me a shot, and it was a brutal early period because I really had so little skill, and he both needed more skill from me and also just as a chop-busting kind of guy. And it was a real crash course for me in learning a lot of technical ability. And right in there, I also, in my attempt to find some kind of work, I went to Harvey Comics, and I figured I could perhaps pull off inking, and I got a job at Richie Rich, and I inked Richie Rich for a year and a half while I was working for Howard, and then school started, so I was kind of part-time in school and part-time working, and then or full-time working. And Seth found that the film deal was so complicated, you know, it was so hard to make films. They were so expensive, and crews and incredible organization. He kind of rediscovered comics himself and decided that he'd join me at Pratt. And it was there after maybe, let's see, in 1979 that we started to piece together decided we wanted to maybe get back to doing a fanzine or something like that. And especially at that point, the whole underground comic scene had collapsed, and what was left was like heavy metal.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. that with the collapse of head shops, for you know, which was a major form of distribution for them, then there was no way to... It just had dried up, and we were still interested in that kind of thing, and there was no outlet, and we just thought, you know, we're going to wait around for an outlet, or are we going to, you know, do something about it? And because of our experience with fanzines, it didn't seem so, you know, like such a leap to self-publish. There was also a lot of artwork that we were seeing on the streets, and in some cases from other students at Pratt, that we wanted to gather as well, and some of it would be like a poster on a lamppost, and that there was a lot of art being done on the streets in New York as we were rolling up to having Reagan be president, Ronald Reagan,
yeah.
For those who, it's been such a long time, and you know, we had there was a hostage crisis in Iran, you know, like 444 days of the hostages, and it looked like we might be, you know, starting World War III, so that's where the title came from.
What point did your work become so political? Had it always been like that, or?
You know, it wasn't. I fiddled around with a lot of different things. I guess the work I was drawn to ended up being political, and I wasn't as much of a conscious decision of I have to be political as... I loved German Expressionism. I loved the underground comics that were, you know, like Last Gasp was publishing Slow Death, and there was all these, you know, eco comics. And I guess I was really drawn to these stories that seemed to go somewhere. And I was finding that the fantasy material was falling away, and that especially with the kind of urgency that the atmosphere in New York had at that point, where it was really... It was pretty down and dirty in New York. The city was still coming out of having gone bankrupt, and there was just a general atmosphere of it felt like a dangerous time, and with the Cold War in full swing, whenever I thought about what I wanted to do, it seemed somewhat frivolous to spend too much time doing things that didn't at least respond to that, but which isn't to say I then didn't do tons of things that were not directly about that. I did a lot of illustration work when I was starting out that was just trying to be employed, and I did God, I did a cat book. One of my first books was a bunch of linoleum prints illustrating a Robert E. Howard story.
Wow.
And so I'm kind of messed around with things, but I kept finding that the one consistent thing that I wanted to do was more subject matter based. That I wanted to do stories that I felt like I won't feel like I just stood by while everything went to hell in a handbasket. And it's so much work to do comics that I just, in order to have the sustain to even do a short piece, I felt like I wanted it to say something.
Did you have any connections with the early punk rock scene in New York?
Not especially. I mean, I went to CBGB's and Max's Kansas City occasionally and felt fairly alienated. I never felt sort of part of any of those scenes. I always was confused by them. The music seemed too loud most of the time, and most of the people seemed so much hipper than me, and I felt like I wasn't dressing especially hip, and everybody just looked like they were in on something that I couldn't understand, and I tried wearing dark sunglasses at night, and I just felt blind, and so I've generally always felt tragically unhip, and not part of any of those kinds of scenes, but I listened to a cross-section of, you know, some of it was fairly poppy, Elvis Costello and Joe Jackson and things like that. I mean, music has always been a fairly important part or a part of the oomph in while working. I've always, as often as possible, had music be, you know, part of what I'm listening to while working for inspiration.
It keeps you going.
Yeah, tremendously.
On that note, why don't we do a music break?
Okay.
What would you like to hear?
I forget what I sent you as the possibles.
I got the...
How about I'm a Loser, since speaking of being tragically...
All right. This is Inkstuds. We'll be right back with Peter Cooper, and we're going to play a little... it's like 1996 all over again. Beck.
Paint the vegetables, dog food stalls with the beefcake pantyhose. Kill the headlights and put it in neutral. Stock car flaming with a loser in the cruise control. Babies in Reno with the vitamin D. Got a couple of couches, sleep on the love seat. Someone came saying I'm insane to complain about a shotgun wedding and a stain on my shirt. Don't believe everything that you breathe. They get a parking violation and a maggot on your sleeve. So shave your face with some mace in the dark. Saving all your food, standing burning down this trailer park. Yo. With a phony gas chamber, cause one's got a weasel and other's got a flag. One's on the pole, shove the other in the bag. With the rerun shows and the cocaine nose jug, the daytime crap of the folk singer's club. He hung himself with a guitar string, a slab of turkey neck, and it's hanging from a pigeon wing. But get right if you can't relate. Trade the cash for the beat, for the body, for the hate. And my time is a piece of wax falling on a termite. He's choking on the splinters.
I'm a loser, baby. So why don't you kill me?
I'm
a loser, baby. So why don't you kill me?
Drive-by body pierce. Yo, bring it on down.
Yeah,
CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Inkstud Show, the radio show where we talk about comics. My guest is Peter Cooper. We were talking about comics and politics and whatnot. That was Beck, Loser, off of... Oh, I can't remember the name of the album.
Mellow Guild?
That's probably it. That's a better memory than mine.
I could be wrong.
that Canadian air thins out everything, and I forget everything. There. I was just looking on your Drodger, and your gallery of yourself, and looking through at your wasted time and self-flagellation. Do you find yourself punishing yourself for your work?
Perpetually. Yes, this is part of the deal. You know, there's the wishing I did something different in some book that will dog me until I get the opportunity to fix it. There's just, you know, you name all the different ways. You know, I wish I worked harder sometimes and less hard other times. And you know, so that's a perpetual human condition state.
Now, I guess we were just talking about World War III Illustrated, and why don't we chat a little bit about the new book, The Silent Issue. Why the choice to do all silent?
Well, I had moved to Mexico for 2 years, and I was just getting back from there. And so there was a combination. I started working on it when we were in the roll-up for the current U.S. elections, and we're coming out of the Bush years with this incredibly long 8-year period, and I felt like I wasn't ready to address everything that had happened over the years, and we'd certainly been doing that in the magazine anyway. And so I wanted to have an issue that would get a little air in it and would be a kind of a before whatever was coming next, and would give us room to not have it be like, okay, if you're going to pick a theme, what's going to be the theme that could encapsulate this time period? Since I had been in Mexico, then there was also the issue of language, and I really enjoyed the fact that the wordless comics I did worked so well when I was encountering people who didn't speak English. So it struck me as being a good mode, a good way. It's not exactly a subject, but a delivery system by picking wordless. It would get people to have that be the thing that holds it together as a theme. And I thought also insanely that this would be an easier issue to edit because I wouldn't be talking about every word and parsing it all out and having to look at, you know, fact check. And it turned out it was triple hard because when I wanted to explain to somebody what I wanted them to adjust, I ended up having to do drawings a lot of the time to clarify it. And it was just, it took longer than any issue I've probably edited. And, but you know, it was one of those experiences where, as almost every issue of World War III is, and I'm kicking myself somewhere in the middle and wondering why the hell I'm still doing it, and then at the end go, that's so great, I'm so glad I did it, and in several more months I'll start imagining doing another issue, or a year.
It doesn't have a set-in-stone release schedule.
Well, we try to be annual at this point. I mean, annual seems to be what we can pull off, considering that, you know, the motivator is not, it's certainly not financial, and it's just a matter of us deciding we're going to get together and do it. And a year is, I think, a comfortable period of time to get an issue together and not somewhere between rushing and also just if you want to get people to work it into their schedules between making a living, then that tends to work out pretty comfortably.
Colin made an interesting remark during the music break about, you know, do you have the same complaints with the new administration? New complaints? New issues of interest?
You know, it's still so fresh that I'm awaiting. You know, I'd really rather take the position of seeing what's going to happen before my back isn't up against the wall of like, oh, here we go again. it's such an extreme difference. I mean, it was so extreme under Bush and Cheney and Rove and that cabal of, you know, just the mafiosos that, you, no matter what, I mean, virtually every day looking at the news is a relative breath of fresh air in as juxtaposed to the Bush administration, where every time I read the paper, it was like, oh, my God, you know, they're dismantling the Constitution as fast as they can. They're, you know, you didn't have any idea how quickly they were going to chew away at the Bill of Rights. And, you know, when somebody's going to come knocking on your door at the rate they were moving. With Obama, I certainly don't feel that level of threat. But then again, you know, there's a lot more that can happen, and including the people who don't want him to do well, and what may occur from that. I at this point, I'm still, my fingers are crossed that he makes it through 4 years or 8 years without being assassinated. Sadly,
when Bush left, there was a common complaint amongst stand-up comics that they're losing a great source of material. Did you have any feelings like that?
Like
source of inspiration?
So. You know, there's going to be a degree to which when you're really up against something, somebody like Bush and Cheney, there's something to write about. And, I mean, it, there's a real fire in your belly at all times. But there's not, you know, since we're at this precipice, so that there's so much to talk about, regardless of who's in power, that fire isn't going away. I mean, I can be talking about the fact that, you know, environmentally speaking, we're, you know, so close to the edge and a tipping point that, you know, we're talking about survival issues, and there's a ton to talk about with something like that. But it's less of the where I want to get in there and draw Obama or Biden, and, you know, with the fervor that I had for Cheney and Bush.
Little Mr. Richie Bush.
A perfect fit.
A perfect fit. Well, that brings to your most recent work. We're going to talk about the book about your time in Mexico, where really international politics, there's still a lot happening outside of even American involvement, I guess.
There was a very bizarre circumstance that I moved to a town when we left the United States in 2006, and the primary reason was for I had a 9-year-old daughter who's now 12, and we wanted her to get a second language and basically kind of replicate the experience I had in when my father moved us to Israel, which is, aside from the different language, it's the lift the needle up, drop her into a culture that outside the United States, and let her be able to see things with a bit of a distance. And so we put her straight into a Spanish-speaking school, and she knew almost no Spanish, and it worked the same way pretty much as it worked when I was in Israel, which is in about 6 months you start to become fluent. And I got my ass kicked a whole lot more than she did, but there was nonetheless, if nothing else, a psychological ass kicking from just being in a place where you don't speak the language and have to kind of scramble and to keep up. And I found that was such a critical turning point in my life, which probably led me into comics and, you know, strengthening my friendship with Seth and recognizing what it's like to be an underdog and be in a situation where you're, you know, being the new kid has this all sorts of psychological things that I think are positive for the long term of your life, although short term it can be pretty hideous. And so we arrived, you know, another reason was that I really was so burnt out on being in Bush, United States, and reading the paper every day with new horrible news and everything that was going on, and thought it might be a good opportunity for a break from that. So we arrived in this town called Oaxaca, which is oddly spelled O-A-X-A-C-A, but pronounced Oaxaca. And the day we arrived, the national elections had just occurred, and they were potentially stolen. And the town that we arrived in was having a teacher's strike that had blown up a bit because the governor who had stolen the election had attacked the teachers who were striking. And that had turned their annual strike, which had been going on for 25 years. Every year they would have this strike, and they would kind of encamp in town for about 2 weeks. the governor, you know, it's kind of like a back and forth understanding. The governor would give them their minimal raise, and they'd go back home. This year, the new governor, first time ever in 25 years, decided I'm not going to give them the money. I'm going to attack them and drive them out. And all it did was it made their strike turn into what became a 7-month strike. And when it started to get bigger in July, and then come October, it was hitting a boiling point. And the governor periodically would have undercover police attack the strikers, who were nonviolent pretty much throughout. I mean, they perhaps threw rocks occasionally. They took over radio and TV stations so they could communicate with each other. But generally speaking, really nonviolent. But he was having his police come in and shoot at him at night. And at the end of October, his undercover police attacked one of the barricades that the strikers had set up and shot 3 people, and one of them was an American journalist named Brad Will. And he was, you can YouTube Brad Will and see, Brad was filming them shooting and filmed himself being murdered. It's a really disturbing video, as you might guess, but it's posted there on YouTube. And when that happened, of course, an American was killed, so it became an international event. And the president of Mexico sent in 4,500 federal troops. And so suddenly, and they, it was like the city exploded, and it was this, the federal troops drove the strikers out of the center of town and took that over. But the strikers just re-encamped like 3 blocks away. And the strike continued for another month. And I went from, you know, so this little settled time we were going to have in a small Mexican town, it turned out we were at the epicenter of a major political event. And I was working on Stop Forgetting to Remember when we got down there. And I worked on it throughout the summer on a really intense deadline. And I barely went downtown. And I was barely following what was happening. I mean, I'd look on the internet some, and I'd go downtown and see the strikers. But it seemed like, okay, I'd read that it had happened annually, and I figured it would wrap up at some point. But then I started to do drawings about it, especially, you know, once I got free from when I finished up Stop Forgetting in September. And I started going to town regularly, and then I realized, you know, I'm ignoring something rather major that's right in front of my face. And this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And so I started sketching all the time and taking photographs. And when the federal troops came, we were getting emails from people saying, you know, like, get out of Mexico. What are you doing there? It's crazy. And I felt like I wanted to let people know what the reality was, which was different than it was being reported even in the New York Times. I shouldn't say even, since they've done their fair share of crap reporting. But I started posting things first to friends, but then it ended up getting on somebody's website and one of my publishers in France, and then it kind of went viral, and then another website asked me to write more formally, and I found myself actually drawing and writing regularly about it and to let people know what was going on. And then I realized, oh, you know, I'm like one of the few people consistently here, because reporters kind of only came in when somebody got killed, and especially if somebody who wasn't, you know, on the rare occasion that somebody who wasn't Mexican got killed. Mm-hmm. So I found that I got this newfound responsibility of in some form to cover it, and I was really interested in applying my art that way. And so I kept on doing it for the entire time that we were there, and that has transformed into a book called Diario de Oaxaca, Diary of Oaxaca, that a Mexican publisher is doing, and an American publisher called PM Press is going to publish. It's going to come out officially this September, and it's bilingual. It got translated by the Mexican publisher, and it covers what was going on during the teacher strike with all my sketchbooks things and some photography and the essays that I was writing, but also then it continues on when things settled down and I just was writing and drawing about life in Mexico.
One thing I remember from when I interviewed Baron's story was the talking about how important it is to record things by sketchbook form, to kind of see things through your eyes. Is that something that really stuck with you from him, or is something that you kind of developed in your own way?
He was one of my teachers, as it happened, at Pratt.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he was an early influence. But I was keeping a sketchbook was something I started when I was in high school. And when I would travel, which I started to define myself as I'm a traveler and I draw in my sketchbook. And somehow, because when traveling, the sketchbook is kind of like the main outlet for capturing events, you know, some photography maybe and some journal writing, but my sketchbook was the thing. And I had a book published called Comic Trips that was a trip through Africa and Southeast Asia that I took with my wife. We went for 8 months. And the work that I did in that time period was all sketchbook. And going to Mexico was getting back in touch with my inner sketchbook, and I really found that to be like the focus of the things I was doing. And since I've been back, it still has been the case where I've been trying to make that be like every day I'm going to draw in my sketchbook, and it ends up being a chronicle of your experience. And each day when you go through this shift, the things across your path that you find interesting to draw end up being a really good diary that if for nobody else, if you look back on it yourself, you get to see like where you were at a given time. I started doing a sketchbook of self-portraits, and I tried to do one a day. I still have been trying to do this. I'm on my fifth book, which is some of the things that you mentioned were posted at Draugr, that website. It ends up being another form of diary writing, which is this is how I feel today, and this is what I trying to capture something about this, and that's another thing that I find with comics that strikes me as being really useful is as a historical document and something like Stop Forgetting to Remember. I was really as quickly as I could trying to get down on paper the experience that I had in a 10-year period. And then jumping back to high school memories and junior high school memories and childhood memories and try to get as much down as I could that I'd be able to look back on. And again, you know, if I didn't sell one copy, I'd at least have this document and go, you know, oh, yeah, right, that's what it was like, which is what, you know, when you're writing your diary, that's the same type of, you know, it's the same motivation is that you might be able to look back at your younger self and get some memory of where you were coming from.
Well, it's interesting looking at your work, and you're talking about this return to sketchbook, because a lot of your stuff is very laborious, it looks. Like, you've put in a lot of work, like, using, I guess, for example, like, the Spy versus Spy stuff, where you have, like, different layers of artwork just to make that one strip.
True.
So is that kind of stepping away from that, it's kind of relieving?
It can be for sure, and especially it's really good and hugely important to step away from anything that has smacks of commercial anything like that you're worrying about. Like, I'm doing this, it's motivated by anything besides, like, I'm going to draw whatever I want in any style I want, whatever, and that's how I've kind of stumbled upon a lot of the different things that I've ever done is by spending time just fiddling around. And it can be difficult when you get out of school to that you feel pressure to have some style together. And I mean, it's a very real pressure because, you know, the art director who gives you a job doesn't want you to show up with a brand new approach that you did on this job when they hired you because they thought you were going to do it a different way. And so the sketchbook is an opportunity to do that whatever and see what kind of develops. And in the sketchbook in Mexico, what happened incidentally was that instead of doing where I was probably much more precious with my sketchbook, where I would depending I draw on one page or I started drawing, you know, single images on one page, and then I started drawing on every part of the page, and then I started connecting things that were, let's say I did a drawing of a Volkswagen in one corner, and then I did a bottle of wine in another place, and then I did a tablecloth, and then some pattern I saw, and then some mask, and I started to form them into something that was probably influenced by all the murals I saw by Diego Rivera and things like that. And it was really kind of subtle, and I actually wondered whether it was one of the atmospheres of Mexico that caused Diego Rivera and these guys to do murals that were these kind of a pastiche where everything blended together, and that just by being in all in the same place, they started to seem like they were connected. And so I do some image of a temple, you know, some ancient ruins, and that would be sitting on the page with somebody talking on a cell phone. And it actually seemed to make sense in a funny way. And then I started blurring that and putting a whole lot of work. I mean, maybe take a week to do a two-page spread in my sketchbook, just because I'd be drawing different things at different times, and I keep coming back to that two pages, and it might take that long while I was doing other pages. And so that I'd just be layering it, not that different than a lot of my illustration work. But that's the kind of thing that ended up in this Oaxaca book, that you can kind of see this progression of more individual images into it gets more and more complicated and overlaid, and that just again kind of came naturally from the experience of trying to get all these different elements and on a daily basis, running into a 15th-century building and a Humvee and then seeing some ruins from BC and then having a beer in front of me,
and of course a beer. I'm gonna do another quick song break because we're getting near to the end of the hour, and then we have another half hour beyond this. So, what would you like to hear now?
Let's see. And I have to remember what I sent you.
We got the Drexler, the Dylan, the XTC.
How about the Drexler, since we're talking about Mexico?
There we go. We'll be right back. Ink Stud, CITR 101.9 FM with our guest, Peter Cooper.
He visto una luz al otro lado del río. El día le irá pudiendo poco a poco al frío. Creo que he visto una luz al otro lado del río. Sobre todo creo que no todo está perdido. Tanta lágrima, y yo soy un vaso vacío. Oigo una voz que me llama, casi un suspiro. Rema, rema, rema. Esta orilla del mundo, lo que no expresa es baldío. Creo que he visto una luz al otro lado del río. Yo muy serio voy remando, muy adentro sonrío. Creo que he visto una luz al otro lado del río. Sobre todo creo que no todo está perdido. Tanta lágrima, y yo soy un vaso vacío. Oigo una voz que me llama, casi un suspiro. Rema, rema, rema. Rema, rema, rema. tu remo en el mío. Creo que he visto una luz al otro lado del río.
CITR 101.9 FM, Ink Studs, the radio show where we talk about comics. It's about 3 o'clock Pacific time, I guess 6 o'clock for our guest, Peter Cooper, who's in Manhattan. Are you in Manhattan?
I'm in Manhattan.
In Manhattan.
Upper West Side, right near Columbia University.
How's your Spanish?
Poco a poco. Está bien. It's okay. I is way worse than it should be after 2 years there, but... I do have a little opportunity every day to speak Spanish here, in my neighborhood especially.
Now, whereabouts in Mexico is Oaxaca located?
It's way south. The next state down below it is Chiapas, where there was another fairly major political event. And where we were staying, I think it's about parallel to the Yucatan. It's, you know, like the... the latitude or longitude, I forget which one.
That would be latitude.
Latitude is the same as the Yucatan, where Cancun is, and that.
So it's
that
on
area.
The Pacific side.
And it's on the Pacific side, and it's the state of Oaxaca and also the city of Oaxaca. So I went from New York to Oaxaca, and the where the city is, it's up in the mountains, and you're far from the ocean, and actually it's really temperate, real nice. Like spring-like weather all year round, and it's always had a fair amount of political activity there. It was one of the things that struck us as being it would be a nice place to live. With.
Yeah, other people might say, maybe I should avoid the area with lots of political activity.
Yeah, well, but you don't want to go to the area where they do the ass kicking, you know, of the liberals.
Yeah. You don't want to move next to one of the local maquiladores. That wouldn't be fun.
Yeah, well, you know, or the other thing we were avoiding was a big city, since we live in, you know, like one of the big ones. And so I was afraid it was going to not be, you know, my little cosmopolitan self with all the years in New York. It was going to seem way too slow. And it wasn't the case at all. It actually has a tremendous amount of art. And there were more openings and things to do in the art world than we could keep up with.
Now,
so that was fantastic, and lots of artists there that I met and had, you know, interactions with, and I helped curate a show of local artists, and you know, so it was really really nice to find a whole other community of artists there.
If only you could find a good bagel.
That was tough.
I think Steve Lafler is not far from where that.
His daughter was going to school. His daughter and son were going to school where my daughter was. And
oh.
So when he moved down there right when I was down there, and we hung out.
Excellent. I knew he was down somewhere around there.
Exactly there.
There we go.
Dog Boy?
Yes.
Dog Boy Steve Lafler?
Yes.
Oh, gosh, I hadn't heard about him in ages.
Yeah, Bugtown.
Bugtown, yeah.
Yeah.
Left Portland for the sunny beaches of Mexico.
Mountains.
Mountains.
Yes, yes. The cool mountains.
The cool mountains. As you said, the spring-like weather.
Yep.
Now, let's talk about Stop Forgetting to Remember. I guess this is something you've been working on a long time, and some of the pieces have been worked out in anthologies and whatnot, and this kind of brings together a lifetime work. Is that what I want to say? Oh, do we still have you there?
Yeah, sorry.
I was asking, Stop Forgetting to Remember, what was the choice of doing that, considering it's not politically pointed like your other work, maybe?
Well, curiously, I actually have found that the personal is political and all that, when you cover subject matter that's, you know, I mean, talking about drug use and sex and a lot of these things that a lot of us have experienced ends up being quite political. And in fact, I probably had more trouble from pieces I did that had sexual topics in them than I did from the overtly political things. So, and there's, you know, and I weaved in a lot of different, I mean, 9/11's part of it, and Bush becoming president, and the impact of that and my feelings about that are part of it. But I'm sort of perpetually trying to figure out new ways to talk about all the different things that are of interest and concern. And I find that humor actually is my favorite way to convey things, and I think most effective. Mad Magazine was a huge influence, and that seeing how they did use politics and humor together, and was really eye opening, and I have often forgotten how important that is, and so I really like to try to talk about a lot of things, but do it in a way that's more with more humor or maybe more more personalized, and so Stop Forgetting was part of that, and it's also, I guess, I've been trying to put my toe in every pond that comics that has the petri dish is out there, and sometimes it's sort of like journalism, and since I have a cross section of influences, Crumb is certainly a huge influence in all those years of reading these autobio stories, and that's one whole area that I like to explore. And so I might do a wordless book. In fact, my previous book was Sticks and Stones, which was a wordless allegory. And then the book before that was Metamorphosis, which is, you know, adapting somebody else's writing. And that I seem to continuously move, jump from, you know, to a different rock that is doing something completely different, but using comics as the connector.
So
if I do something like a stencil strip with no words, and then the next thing I'm doing is not likely to be that, and just for, if nothing else, for boredom, you know, the boredom issue is pretty big, that I just feel like, wow, I really used up the whole stencil and wordless thing, and I actually also did a children's book in between there, and that's some of it as well. But I really enjoy doing autobiographical comics, and like I said, if nothing else, if I don't sell one copy, I end up with a document that says that this is what that time period was like for me, and I have one really sad publisher.
So can we look forward to the Peter Cooper Captain America?
I did Captain America, a little in Captain America Red, White, and Blue. I did a two-page strip where Captain America is fighting the Red Skull, and he throws his shield and knocks out the Red Skull, and discovers that the A that is normally on his shirt is turned into an N, and then he's got like a he rips his shirt open, he's got a swastika, and he rips his mask off, and he's Hitler, and then the Red Skull comes over, and there's a heart-shaped panel where they're kissing, and then in the last panel, he's waking up and he's saying, "That's the last time I have the rare bit K rations."
The one thing that
Marvel would not let me do when I did that piece, because I did it for Marvel, was I had Bucky Barnes next to him in bed saying, Cap, wake up." they drew the line right there, but I felt like I had crossed the line so far that it was okay.
Violence is okay. But men sharing a bed.
Actually, what I just finished doing was a Treehouse of Horror Simpsons story. So on the completely, now for something completely different category.
There we go. How did it feel to be taking over Spy versus Spy for Mr. Proyas?
Well, unexpected, to say the least. I didn't approach them. They approached me about it, and I had done the system for Vertigo, and that was all wordless. And so, and I also did this comic strip, Eye of the Beholder, which I was syndicating in alternative papers, and that was also wordless. So I guess arrows were pointing in my direction when they were talking about revamping Mad back in '96, And so they called me in and asked me if I wanted to do a tryout for it, and I think they were asking several people. And I almost said no on the spot because I thought, I don't want to do somebody else's characters. There's going to it's entirely too much. I was really headed in the trajectory of wanting to, aside from my own writing, have it be, you know, real, more political or something or other. I was on my high political horse at that particular point, and I just felt like, oh, that'd be somebody else's thing, and I'm not going to follow, you know, Prohias. And I went home and thought, well, you know, what can it hurt? So I did a tryout piece and thought, all right, well, I'm going to just push it, and I'll do it in stencils, and that way they're sure to say no quickly, and I will have done my one Spy versus Spy. And it turned out that was a direction. They wanted to shake up the direction, and so then I thought, well, okay, I'll do it for a year, and, you know, how bad can that be? And then every year there's kept on being some other reason why it seemed like a good idea, and when I was really starting to feel burnt out, Mad went color. And that gave me the opportunity to do a whole other set of things. So that was more impetus to keep going with it. And and it's hung around. And now that Mad's quarterly, excuse me, I'm getting another call, so I'll ignore that. Now that Mad's quarterly, it's not going to be so much part of my life, although there is the possibility that I'll end up doing some kind of graphic novel, Spy versus Spy graphic novel. I'm not quite sure yet.
The gag strip that never ends.
Yep, keeps going. But, you know, I mean, I've convinced myself periodically that, you know, it was based originally on the Cold War. There are no winners, you know, there's only us losers, and you know, the futility of war and all that, which is, it's really actually itchy and scratchy, and or vice versa, and that it's really fun just to get inside my 10-year-old self periodically and blow things up.
What about Gray Spy?
She shows up once in a while. The last one I did, and in the latest issue, as the Gray Spy.
Oh, okay. Is that in Mad 500?
Yep, the first quarterly issue.
Now that it's in color, will there be a red spy, a green spy?
It's been in color for, I don't know, 8-9 years now.
It's a while.
Yeah.
So there was a collection that came out maybe a year or two ago that was of my first 10 years, and it goes to color pretty quickly. Maybe I did 2 years, 2-3 years of Black Widow. I'm in my 11th or 12th year now.
Wow.
Gulp.
Tell me about the stencil process.
It's completely insane and highly toxic. I do a pencil drawing, and then I cut the stencil with an... I photocopy the pencil, and then I cut the stencil with an X-Acto knife, and it's loose photocopy paper, so that makes it really easy to be more fine about the cutting. And I cut out the large areas that are going to be the solid blacks, or dark areas in it, as much as I can, but, you know, the panel borders are not in there, and I leave a lot of background out that I'll put in later. Then I put that on watercolor paper, and I spray with spray paint. There's no airbrush or anything like that. It's just cans of spray paint. Red paint, and then without moving the stencil, I spray black paint on top of that, and that gives you a slightly glowing underglow of red. And then so you have this sort of base image, and then I light box from the original pencil and put the panel borders in and all the different details and maybe collage in, you know, a toxic waste do not touch sign or something like that, and then watercolor and colored pencil and a little white paint, and so it's sort of, It's fairly fully painted by the time I'm done with it. And I do it same size also, so that what you see in print in the magazine is the size that the original is.
Wow. I hope you work.
For some reason, nobody else seems to have taken up this style as being a great idea for comics.
No, especially since the invention of Photoshop would make a little less messy, but not as exciting.
There's the X factor that you get from doing something like that, and I like that very much, but I am moving away from it because it's just really toxic, and even though I have a spray booth and I wear a mask and wear rubber gloves and all this stuff, it's still plain old, it is toxic, and I hate that aspect of it. And so, you know, there's something about doing an illustration about the degrading environment while I'm using spray paint.
CFCs.
That's just a little too, like, shedang. What am I doing again?
What does Seth have to say?
About spray paint or about everything?
About the spray paint aspect of doing...
He has to say, you ripped that off from me, because the first time I saw anybody doing that in that way was Seth. And I saw an illustration that he did, and he did a strip called You Don't Have to Fuck People Over to Survive, which is also a book he did, which is on its about to have its third printing, I mean the third reissuing from a third publisher. He did that strip in stencils, and there was something about the immediacy of it and this sort of action street art that it connects to something old, like the German Expressionist work and woodcut work, and yet has this sort of quality that is very modern. And that I love that in it. There's really no other way to achieve that. You'd have to work pretty hard in Photoshop to get something that looks like that. And a lot of the, in Oaxaca, there was a tremendous amount of street art that was done in these giant stencils. In fact, I've included a bunch of those in my book. I was chronicling a lot of the work on the walls that was slowly was disappearing as, you know, somebody had put up some image of rioters throwing a Molotov cocktail at the police, done in this giant elaborate stencil, and then, you know, a week later it'd be painted over. And so I grabbed a lot of imagery that was all real temporary. And it always just had this, like, every time I saw it, it was like a beautiful punch in the face, a happy punch in the face that I would have been drawn to. And I was doing linoleum prints when I was in art school, and I did some illustration work like that, and I found it so labor intensive, and it, when you go to print linoleum or woodcut, it's reversed, and I loved that aspect of it because it actually, again, we had that surprise element, and I seem to be drawn to art forms that you don't know where you're going to get till the end. Even like with scratch board, which is this chalk-covered paper that I used to do Metamorphosis, and in fact also Stop Forgetting to Remember, is all done on scratch board. And you can scratch into the lines and get this slightly woodcut feeling, and it's all will print. You know, you could photocopy it down to postage stamp size and it'll still print perfectly, but you can scratch the lines to make it look like it's almost a half tone. And I've just always liked that kind of work. And Eric Drucker is a longtime friend, and another person whose work I just loved also uses scratch board. And that there's just this kind of immediate oomph that kind of work gets that I've been always drawn to.
I saw in Toronto, I picked up these really wonderful books by this German woman, Anka Fuschenberger.
Oh, yeah, she's fantastic.
And they're incredible. They're mostly scratchboard, and it's just the most, like, I don't know how to describe it, but very incredible. Check out her website.
Well, also somebody like Thomas Ott, who Fantagraphics has published a whole series of his beautiful wordless scratchboard books. That's all scratchboard. When you see something that looks like it's kind of somewhere between woodcut and very careful cross-hatching lines, that often is scratchboard.
And also, I got to see some a Wally Wood original scratchboard that looks fantastic.
Huh.
I was wondering, you've been involved in comics for a long time and political comics, and I was just wondering, What do you think of the younger generation of cartoonists these days that, to me, seem to be politically disconnected?
I'm disconnected from a lot of the work that's coming out, especially having been gone for a couple of years. But I'm encountering a lot of very politically motivated comics that are being done in World War III by a lot of young people. So I keep seeing very political comics done that way, but there's a lot of, you know, things, autobiographical work, and a cross section of things that people are doing that I think is very interesting. I mean, so much is going on in comics. There's such an explosion of work. It's really hard to keep up with all the things that are happening, and I figure that a lot of the people are doing what I did, which is they're in the process of developing their voice and deciding what they're going to do. And, you know, somebody like Crumb did plenty of work that was, you wouldn't consider political, but he's done some really seriously political work. And there's a lot of, again, the personal work can often be quite political.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, you know, I surely don't mind work that is there to entertain I'm not currently feeling like, boy, the young people sure don't have any enthusiasm for doing anything, because in part, well, we motivated enough to get a different kind of president in the United States, and so my sense of a younger generation getting motivated is a little more raised. It doesn't seem like it's all apathy, and I don't know, you know, it's such a mixed bag, because I feel like that the word politics it sounds like lead shoes a lot of the time when you're saying it's political work, and it immediately I think, oh man, this is going to be boring and tutorial. And I'm really always trying to find a way to be really entertaining when I do the different things that I do, and look for work that manages to straddle those things. If something ends up being too political, it's easy for a lot of political work to get self-righteous and not communicate and be so sure of what it's saying that it almost doesn't care if the audience is listening.
So dogmatic.
And, yeah, it gets dogmatic, and I always fear that in my own work, and that's one of the real pitfalls. But I feel like we're, odds are pretty good. Everybody is rubbing up against these real things that are going on in our lives, and that it's like, I mean, politics is kind of like a fire on your couch, where if you say, oh, I'm not into politics, it's like, well, it's burning there, and it is affecting you, and you are going to have to react to it, even if it's, you know, moving over and eventually, you know, leaving the building before you catch on fire yourself. And I think that some of the comics that people are doing that is talking about the current state of mind includes that quality that we're all experiencing of us being in this kind of precipice. And, you know, everybody's reacting differently, and so there's a lot of information in a lot of the things that people are doing that isn't overtly political, but yet will have that, have aspects of our current history in it.
I think I got to disagree with what Colin said as far as younger cartoonists not having necessarily these political bent, because one thing we're seeing right now is a whole generation of cartoonists that kind of have a different viewpoint on the world and a certain psychological impact on what you're raised in the Bush years. And I think we have yet to see really how that's going to result in a lot of work. I think a lot of new folks we see coming out right now are really in their formative years. And
yeah, it takes a really long time to get your chops together for comics. I'm amazed when I see somebody doing, you know, that very together work at a really early stage, because there's just so many aspects to it. And I mean, we are now a much more visually oriented culture, and there is a tremendous amount of sequential thinking and exposure to, you know, through the internet and a lot of different things that makes newer generations way more visually adept, I think, which is why there is more work that seems to move forward faster. I mean, when I was in art school, there was no comics class. Most of the teachers I had regarded comics as not art and discouraged them. And it was now, you know, I go back to Pratt and I'll give a talk in a sequential art class, and that sequential thinking is taught.
Yeah.
And it's part of the curriculum, and it's so much part of what they woke up and said, you know, you have to get with this program in teaching students, because this is what is being demanded of them when they go out and to work. It's really interesting. I mean, it's one of the really great things of having been involved in comics for such a long time is that I was working in an art form, and we were all working in an art form that what we were being told wasn't an art form. And it's nice to know absolutely solidly that what you believe is true, even in the face of the larger population telling you that it's not, because it's clarifying. It's like, well, you know, I don't have one shred of doubt that what I'm doing is an art form. And so if you tell me it's not, then, you know, if the art world as a whole says it's not, then I just know what bullshit the art world is.
Fuck them.
And that it's just not, you know, and that's like, oh, okay, right. So you guys are actually totally myopic, and that, you know, being utterly convinced about something and then having the good fortune, unlike a lot of our predecessors, that we actually have been around to see it come around in the larger publishing world. You know, I went from only being able to work for small publishers who paid me almost nothing and had trouble getting distribution in any bookstore to Random House publishing my books with, you know, first print runs of 15,000 copies and you know, it being distributed to every, you know, Barnes & Noble or whatever easily. And this being the new big publishing expanding area, which is now, you know, I think in certain ways there's some contraction there, but nonetheless, it's really heartening to have something that you know from your core, starting when you were 11, and then and having something pushing against that, having lots and lots of people saying that it's not of value, and then having it be proven true. It's like being Sarah Connor and telling everybody that the world is, I tell you, the robots are going to take over.
They're coming. They're coming. I have to cut us off. It's that time.
It's only been 5 hours, though.
The fastest 5 hours. Thank you so much, Peter.
Thank you.
You ended on a pretty good note there. An appropriate note, maybe.
The Sarah Connor note?
The Sarah Connor note. There we go. Obama is a robot. That's what we'll leave it on.
But I don't recommend Terminator 4.
I barely even watched 3. I probably won't watch 4, except I do love the listening to Christian Bale swear like a truck driver. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Once again, Peter. And I look forward to more comics. Look forward to the Oaxaca book.
Very good.
So, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
I'm going to wind this up real quick. Up next is The French Connection, and next week we'll be chatting with Dave Lapp and I record an interview. They'll be playing with Brian Sendelbeck. Smell of Steve used to be in the Terminal City years ago. Colin doesn't know. He used to come up for a lot of comic conventions at the Heritage Hall. New collection, Planet of Beer, from Dark Horse, and Dave Lapp's book, Drop In from Conundrum. Good Canadian boy. Let's support the Canadians. Up next, French Connection.
Of war and peace, the truth just twists its curfew gull. It glides upon four-legged forest clouds. The cowboy angel rides with his candle lit into the sun, though its glow is waxed in black. All except when 'neath the trees of Eden, the lamppost stands with folded arms, its iron claws attached to curbs neath holes where babies wail, though its shadow's metal badge. All in all can only fall with a crashing but meaningless blow. No sound ever comes from the gates of Eden. The savage soldier sticks his head in sand and then complains shoeless hunter who's gone deaf but still remains upon the beach where hound dogs bay at ships with tattooed sails, heading for the gates of Eden. his lamp. Sits with utopian hermit monks, side saddle on the golden calf. And on their promises of paradise, you will not hear a laugh. All except inside the gates of Eden. Relationships of ownership, they whisper in the wings. To those condemned to act accordingly and wait for succeeding kings. And I try to harmonize with songs the lonesome sparrow sings.
French Connection avec Marie-Ève Dumoulin.